I want to start off by, first of all, thank you for doing this with us. I really appreciate it and appreciate you sharing all of your wisdom and experience with me.
My pleasure.
I am so excited to chat with you, particularly because I've had the pleasure of knowing you for quite a number of years now, not nearly as much as obviously some of the other amazing relationships you've built in the industry, but for me, it's been the better part of my experience in the hospitality industry. And you have such a wealth of experience and knowledge in this industry. And I want to go all the way back to what sparked your interest in hospitality, because I know it sparked, when I was at the hotel school and at Cornell, taking all those classes. But what for you got you interested in this amazing industry?
Well, it was quite accidental. Being a first-generation college student, really didn't have a lot of family, friends, or relatives in terms of career guidance. I thought I was going to be a civil engineer. I came to Cornell to be a civil engineer, and it turned out I was a failed engineer. And I transferred to the hotel school. Matter of fact, spent one semester in what was then known as the unidentified division, and took courses, classes in that hotel school, and fortunately, they accepted my transfer, and that's how I got into the hotel business.
I'm curious, when you were taking those classes, what did you initially think when you signed up? So I'd never even heard of the hotel school before I even got to campus.
I don't think I've heard of hotel school until I got to Cornell, The reason I picked the hotel school over the other schools because I came to Cornell to go to college to get a better job. Back in the 70s, corporate jobs is sort of where the opportunities are. Entrepreneurship was not nearly as available as it is today. So that's what I was going to do. And when I looked at the curriculum, the hotel school offers a very strong business curriculum. And even if I didn't like the hotel business, I thought at least I would have a business education.
Yeah, for anyone that's not familiar with Cornell's business program, now it's changed a little bit since I was there when I graduated in 2019, and I'm sure when you were there. But the hotel school is very much a business degree, but with a specialization in hospitality. And so when I started there, I had no idea, A, that the school existed, but also that I'd be taking all of my accounting classes there and some of my finance classes and even marketing, et cetera. Obviously, there's more operational classes, some others, but it was so interesting to find out that they had a very strong specialization in business. Now, when you went through your time at Cornell, when did you start realizing what you wanted to focus on, or what did you want to go into? Because there's a lot of jobs you can get out of the hotel school.
Yes, I really didn't know. And looking back, I didn't really have to know at the time. But, there's a lot of pressure when your classmates are like, I'm going to go into restaurants. Oh, I'm going to go into rooms. And it's like, what do you want to do? I really didn't know. And I interviewed with restaurant companies, hotel companies, and Sheraton offered me an opportunity to go into financial management. And I thought, hey, maybe that's a way to see the business from a business perspective, from a financial perspective. And I always enjoy operations, the guest contact, the people, interactions and all of that. But I decided to go into the industry through the financial area. Most of my classmates didn't do that. I mean, if they went
Do
into
most people go
financial,
into operations, or where did they
no,
go?
they went to operations, some went to consulting. Very few at the time went into real estate finance and all that. But I learned a lot about the business from the financial side of it. But I was always interested in the business. I was not going to be an accountant. I was not going to be a CPA, but I wanted to know more about the business from a financial standpoint.
Now, obviously, you've taken on many roles since your time at Sheraton. So walk me through some of those early career moves and what you were doing in your early years in the hospitality industry.
I would say I was in the first 5 years with Sheraton. I was on a fast track. I was taking a lot less time to advance. I had four different positions in 5 years with Sheraton, moving from coast to coast. So that gave me a lot of exposure to many different kinds of hotels, different size of operations, and also ownership. because that was the beginning of, you know, some hotels were still owned by Sheraton. Others were joint ventures. Others were leased. And then the newest thing at the time was management contract. So that gave me a lot of exposure to the various ownership structures of the hotels. And an opportunity came along for an independent hotel at the time, the Disneyland Hotel in Anaheim. They were looking for a VP of finance. And I got recruited. I joined them. And a few years later, Disney acquired the entire company. And I got the opportunity to come back to Sheraton in Hawaii on a sort of a divisional controller job overseeing the Hawaii Japan division at the time. Spent 5 years there and got my executive MBA. And then Sheraton gave me an opportunity to move into operations and development. And that's a big break, because a lot of companies, certainly American companies, tend to career track their people in the same discipline. And I think
was that common at the time, or was that just like a really one-off for you?
Well, it was definitely a one-off, but I think this is what happened, was that even though I don't have the operations background, Sheraton, the executives knew, you know, who I am and the way I manage, I lead. And also going to Asia, in Hong Kong, I have the cultural and language skills that many others would not. So if you look at, you know, people as a basket of skills, some areas I was missing and other areas I have an advantage on. So they took a chance with me. And I spent 3 years in Hong Kong running North Asia for Sheraton operations as well as development. Now, this is 1993. So this is the very early stage of what I call the Walmart effect on China. So there was a lot of growth going on, but still very early. After 3 years, I was recruited by Westin, which was a separate company at the time, owned by Starwood Capital and Goldman Sachs' Whitehall Fund, and to run, to be the president of Westin Asia Pacific. Wow. That was great. And then 2 years later, the Starwood merger happened, and I got the opportunity to run Starwood Asia Pacific, which, you know, because I knew Sheraton as well as Westin. So now, 75 hotels, you know, whatever the revenue was at the time.
What age were you at this time, if you don't mind me asking?
My goodness.
It sounds like it progressed very quickly.
Yeah. So, at the time when I joined Westin, I was 40. So wow. I was 42 when I ran Starwood Asia Pacific. And then 2 years later, someone I worked with at four different companies became the CEO of Wyndham International, which was at the time a real estate company, and brought me back to the U.S. to be president and COO. So, you know, that was what, 44? Yeah, it's been a tremendous career. You know, first 5 years was fast track. After that was like skipping floors. It's quite incredible. Way beyond what I thought was possible when I graduated.
Yeah. Why do you think that you were progressing so quickly? I mean, I think the finance experience obviously helped, but it couldn't have been just that. What about you or your, maybe it was timing or your work ethic? What do you think it was that helped you jump so quickly?
I worked hard. And I remember when Barry Sterling, when he was with Starwood Capital, interviewed me for the Asia Pacific Westin job. He asked me, do you consider yourself average working, hard working, very hard working? It's like, you know, trick question. I said, I'm hard working.
I would answer that question.
Middle of the road, right? He said, how many hours do you work a week? I said, about 80 hours. And he said, 80? What do you consider very hard working then? You know, I said, hey, come on, you guys are from private equity. Are you going to compare hours with me? You know, you guys work a lot more than that. And also, you know, working in Asia Pacific, you really do a shift and a half, because there's a lot of things you have to deal with at the headquarter level that you start at 9 o'clock at night, right? You got your day job, and then you got to spend half a day dealing with headquarters. So I think hard work is certainly one of the areas. The other thing I did well, first of all, I was a much better employee than I was a student. I think taking care of my bosses on what is it they're looking for and how to deliver on it. And I think, well, every job I've had came from someone who knew me. So the endorsement, the recommendations, has been, you know, tremendous. That's a big part, I think, of, the skipping steps or skipping floors. You know, we're never fully ready for a job, right? You're not ready until you've done it. Well, if you only get jobs that you're ready for, that means you're not really progressing. So, you know, the for me, it was not afraid to take on jobs that I don't think I was prepared for or qualified, because I'll learn it, you know. So, yeah, I mean, you know, leading hotels of the world is a fine example of something that I was not ready for, but, you know, I'll learn it.
Fair. And do you think that at any point in time, were you applying for any of these roles, or they all came from recommendations from previous bosses or people you worked with?
I have never applied for a job. I mean, after I started with Sheraton, I have never applied. They came knocking. Some of them, it's through conversations of exploration and not direct. You know, if you hear there's an opportunity, you talk to somebody who's familiar with it. And just to find out more about it. I remember the job, for Sheraton job in Hawaii, I was speaking to somebody who turned it down. He's a friend of mine, and I was asking him why, and, you know, and asked him, I said, you know, do you think I would qualify? And he said, it'd be a stretch, but don't call them, I'll call them. So it was not me calling directly, but it was certainly somebody who was willing to stick their neck out, you know, for me.
Sure. They never formally asked. They were more vouching for you, which is even more helpful.
Yeah. It's you know, if you live a clean life and try to help people, it's amazing how it comes back. Never keep score, but just keep doing good things for, you know, helping people, and it'll come back to you. Not from everybody, and some of them come from people who you never even helped. You know, it works.
That's so funny you say that, because you just reminded me of our mutual friend, Nelson Billington. I think he was the first person that probably learned it either from you or someone else at the hotel school as well. But the concept of not keeping score and doing everything you can to help or support or guide someone, typically, you know, like you said, supporting a boss and just making sure that you're taking care of their needs, et cetera. For someone that's trying to get ahead, whether they're starting out in a role, starting a company, trying to raise capital, can you talk a little bit more about, like, that kind of generosity that you'd provide or not keeping score? Was that like a mentality that you had, or was it just something that you started practicing?
No, it came from a book written by the first chief marketing officer of Starwood mm-hmm. Hotels and Resorts, a guy named Keith Ferrazzi. He wrote multiple books. This book is called Never Eat Alone. Mm. And I remember reading it, and one of the chapters is about never keep scores. It's a book on networking, and a lot of people think about networking as, what can I get out of it? You know, let me collect business cards and all of that. That's great. But that's not what networking is about. Networking, it's like a bank account. It's what you put into it. You know, so if you're helping other people, if you're doing favors with no expectation of anything in return, you have a rich bank account out there. You never know when you may need it or want it. And people, you know, will return favors. But that's not why you did it. You did it just to help people. You know, whereas the conventional networking is all about withdrawal. You know, how can I call somebody and get a favor? Well, you know, that pretty soon you're overdrawn and nobody wants to take your call. You know, one of the areas that I remember being pretty generous about is giving people references. And I don't do references like, he was great, really enjoy working with him. I will get into the specifics of the type of work that person did, and maybe even some results, because those are the most powerful type of references that somebody can walk away with. Now, you know, you get calls from HR people who just want to check the box. versus the people who are actually doing the hiring of the person, and they want to know that this is someone's going to perform well for me. So that's one area that we can always help people in terms of references. And also, when I hear about a job, when I hear opportunities, recommending people and forwarding the opportunities. And, you know, those are small favors. You've been to my Cornell O'Talley Chinatown Eating Club. You know, that's my contribution of getting people to meet each other. And no agenda, just, you know, to meet people and have a connection.
There's so much that's great about that. I think one of the challenges that I found when I started, like, especially while as a student, and also again, when I was starting Lucia and TripKit the first time, I found constantly that I couldn't necessarily provide or offer anything, or at least it felt that way. And I've realized over time that that's not necessarily true, but a lot of times it always felt that way, that I couldn't be helpful or couldn't be useful. Is there any recommendations on someone who feels like they have absolutely nothing to give? Is there any way that they could be useful, or should they just, you know, if you're a graduating student, just accept the help and one day potentially be able to repay the favor?
Yeah, you know, early on, you're probably going to feel like you have less to offer. But, you know, look for the opportunities, be present to it, and it's okay if you don't have a lot to offer at the moment. You know, you can offer backwards to current students. That's certainly one area. You know, you don't always have to help, you know, CEO or whatever, help your colleagues. Just be in the mindset of helping others. And that it conditions you to see the opportunities. And when you have the opportunity, do so.
Amazing. Well, I'm curious to get back to your timeline, if that's okay. You were at Wyndham and starting that role. What happened from there in the timeline of your career?
Well, we were sold to Blackstone, and the Blackstone kept the real estate and sold the brand to Sendon at the time, which is the company Wyndham Hotels and Resorts, or Wyndham Worldwide, is the company formerly known as Sendon Hotels and Resorts. They bought the brand Wyndham and changed their name. You know, Blackstone kept the real estate. The company was sold for, I think, about $3.4 billion in 2005. And I think they sold the brand and the management company for $100 million. Because Blackstone was not interested in brand operations. They were only interested in real estate until they bought Hilton. Then they probably kicked themselves and say, we should have kept Wyndham, have one more brand, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, they're doing fine. So I left and I was exploring an entrepreneurial project that I had thought about. The idea came to me when I was working as a corporate manager. I remember after Wyndham, I went to help Barry Sternlicht acquire the Société du Louvre transaction in 2005, I think, the French company Concorde. And I was staying at a Sofitel. I get up in the morning, have a light breakfast, walk to the law office, and work there probably until midnight, and walk back to the hotel and go to sleep, and then next day, rinse and repeat. You know, and I realized how spoiled I was working for a hotel company, that I roll out of bed, go to the gym, and the meetings are generally at the hotels. And I didn't have to leave at all. So I came up with an idea of putting a very small, dedicated hotel in a very large office building. Not a full-service hotel in an office building, but only about 40 rooms or so. If I lease 25, one floor, it'd be about 25,000 square feet. I can turn that into about 40, 44 guest rooms, a fairly good-sized guest room. And I would operate that just serving the visitors at the building, right? So it's a different business model, because I wrote down everything that's working and everything that's not working in the hotel business at the time. We're a terrible user of real estate. We have so much non-revenue space. We have too much complexity in the business, and we rely so heavily on distribution. And so on and on, I list everything that's not working in the business and then what's working. And what seemed to me was working really well was the tower floors of these upscale hotels, where they have private lounges and they get a good rate. So that's when I pursued that idea, and I actually started to talk to landlords in office buildings in Dallas, and I was looking for AA, AAA buildings, but I wanted somewhere between 70% and 90% occupy, because below 70 there's not enough traffic for me. Above 90, they don't need me. My value proposition to the landlord was, I am a rent-paying tenant that also creates an amenity for your building. And so that was a good value proposition. I was out of the business of real estate. I have no ballrooms. I have no swimming pools. So yeah, I pursued that idea for a couple of years. We were actually at the face of lease negotiation with some landlords in the building, in some of the buildings here in Dallas. So that was fun. But I can't call myself an entrepreneur because I never generated a single dollar of revenue. And then opportunities started coming up, and I decided to take the leading hotels job instead.
I wouldn't say that you can't call yourself an entrepreneur, because that's a bit of a stretch, because I know plenty of entrepreneurs that don't necessarily make revenue off the bat, but I appreciate that. So you were doing this for a couple of years, 2 years, 3 years, like what was that timeline for you?
Well, I remember I had a 2 year severance, so I felt pretty comfortable.
But it was
more than 3 years. I pursued the idea for about 2-3 years.
Mm, okay. And then Leading came along. And what was that job for?
That was for the CEO, president, CEO of Leading Hotels. And I was absolutely a long shot. You know, I was not the right candidate for Leading Hotels. I remember the headhunter called me and said, have you heard of Leading Hotels of the World? It's like, yeah, everybody's heard of Leading Hotels of the World, but we love the assets you have, the properties that you have, but we don't think you're very serious business people. You know, we think you're kind of a clubby guy, and not really, we don't really worry much about competing with you. And he said, well, that's part of the problem, is that they're 80 years old and they don't know if they be around for another 80 years. Things are changing so much. And as a matter of fact, I told him, I said, I jokingly said, you know, I don't own a single Brioni suit. I probably couldn't order wines in your dining room, and I wouldn't know the silk content of your wallpaper. And he's a humorous guy. He said, yeah, we have plenty of those as general manager. We don't, that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for somebody who can help us run the business and to make sure we continue. So for me, what I brought to the table, what they wanted, was my business skills, my market knowledge of North America, Asia Pacific, and then also knowing how chain brands operate. Because that's where they felt competition was coming from, not from Prefer or Relais & Chateau, but from the chain brands.
Interesting.
What I didn't know very well was European businesses, independent operations, even though I have a little bit of dabbling into it, and then the luxury segment. So the things I don't know is what interests me to the job. The things that I do know is what they want from me. So it was a good balance coming into that job, with things that I want to learn more about and then things that I can contribute.
Wow. And you were, I mean, how long did that interview process take? Was it a short period of time that?
Oh, it took forever. It started in June of 2007. And I started the job in September of 2008. Yeah, took more than a year.
Now, obviously, the market changed quite a bit in 08. So were you walking into that job as
all I started September 1st, and 2 weeks later, Lehman Brothers went down.
Yeah. And what was that like?
Scary. But, you know, somebody said to me, isn't this a terrible time to join a luxury hotel group? And my answer was no, nothing but up now. You know, no one can blame me for the recession, but certainly, you know, to build, you know, from a low base, it's great. And leading was really a wounded animal, as I would say. And it was not performing well at all. So there's a lot of room for improvement, for transformation. I tell students today, you know, I didn't ask for it, but I end up getting quite a few turnaround operations. And, you know, it's hard work, but it can be so rewarding to turn these giant, you know, sort of machines around that doesn't seem to be functioning well at all. It takes a lot of work, but, you know, the rewards are there.
Curious, this is like a two-part question, so maybe we start with the first, but I'm curious, I know leading today, what was leading then? What was different about the hotels that were part of their network? What was different about their brand? I'm curious what that brand stood out as to you then.
Well, several aspects of it. First of all, quality was not there. The company added hotels for financial reasons because they were doing joint ventures and all of that. But they just want to add and add and add. I remember one of the first, or not the first, but one of the early board meetings I went to, the managing director of LQA, who does the inspections, came in to report, and he showed a slide of all the brands that LQA audited. It's like a dozen brands that they audited. And leading hotels average was dead last. And I was shocked because I had not known that beforehand. But what was most shocking was the board members were not shocked. So it's like they've seen it before. They have normalized it. And somebody even said, well, you know, the other brands have fewer hotels. I tell that to a customer. You know, we're big, so therefore we're not good. It's like, no, you can't. That doesn't fly.
Wrong answer. Wrong answer.
So that was number one, was that they have driven quality down to a point that, I don't know, they drove the quality. The quality fell to a point that it was just not acceptable to call yourself leading hotels of the world. So that process, I knew I had to terminate a lot of hotels. So we probably terminated more than half of the hotels that I received quietly. Well, many of them terminated us too. And so because we weren't performing. So number two, revenue. We were not performing revenue. There's a measurement that I started instituting when I started. It's called RevX, right? Revenue multiple. Basically, it's a simple calculation of what's the revenue we drive, what's the fee, and what is the revenue a multiple of the fees. When I started, it was below 9. You say, well, 9's not too bad, about 11%. Well, that includes all the revenue, GDS, I mean, that's went through leading, right? So it's not the 5% franchise fee on any revenue, but still, when I left, the revenue multiple was 20. Okay, so that's how, you know, yes, good job, Ted, but it tells you how badly it was performing at the time. Yeah. And then I say, lastly, it was culture. There were some great people at leading that I would describe the culture as go the extra mile. They would go above the call of duty. And that's what I think made leading so famous in terms of their service. But there were also a lot of people. The tone of voice is, are you good enough? I mean, that was sort of the worst part. And it went between leading, within leading, and it went between leading and some of the members, and the members came back. It was a culture of fear. It was a culture of looking down. And to me, luxury does not mean looking down. Luxury is always to bring out the best, but there was that snootiness. Are you good enough?
Mm. How did you get rid of that?
Well, how do you get rid of culture? You start with people.
Yeah. Did you make massive changes on the people side of things, or did that take more time?
Well, there was an event about 2 months into my job. My predecessor tried to go to the board to get me fired. The person solicited support from a few other senior executives. It was like a coup. Not a conversation with me, but went straight to the board. So the board sent me down at the annual convention and said, this is what's being said. I mean, the stuff, the petty stuff, the ugly, gossipy stuff and all of that. And I said to the board, I said, hey, you know, it's your choice. You can stay the course or you can get rid of me. You know, it's up to you. Because I figure if they would get rid of me for this stuff, that's not a company I want to be with anyway. So, you know, the board decided to back me because I made a business case, because what I was asking questions about, they made a lot of people very nervous. You know, it turned out my predecessor supported my candidacy because he was hoping I would do a capital transaction on the company based on my financial background.
True.
So
yeah.
When I started looking and I say, how do we improve the company? He's like, oh, wrong horse. And so he started all of that. So once the board decided to back me and I presented a business plan, a 5-year business plan, I still remember, it was presented in Paris, and one of the board members, there were two really good corporate business board members at the board. And one of them said, this is the best plan I've seen since my years with leading. And then another one said, this is a very compelling case. So the board backed me. And so I came back, terminated the COO, the CMO, the CFO, the VP of strategic planning. You know, it's like, listen, I'm happy to work with all of you. I don't know you. You have a fair shot at it. But if you're going to put a knife through my back, you know, 60 days into it.
Yeah, it's hard, you know, to come back around and build a community.
We're not going to get along real well, you know. So we might as well end it here. And so that was a big, big, you know, deal at the time. But, you know, so then you start, you know, changing culture. You know, a lot of it is modeling it. A lot of it is you know, recognition for the right behavior and results. And then, you know, have conversations about those that's not acceptable.
Now, did you help the properties themselves with any? You weren't helping them operationally, correct? Or were you at the time?
No, we didn't own hotels. We didn't run hotels.
Right.
You know, we try to support our hotels with everything revenue, right?
Right.
But, you know, I mean, obviously it does involve some of the operations when they don't do well, but it was mostly revenue area.
Okay. And so, and obviously Leading still has that same framework and same business model today, I'm assuming.
I believe so. I don't know for sure.
I don't think it's changed on that front.
The current CEO, I hired her as a CMO. From Amex, and
right.
5 years before my departure. And I remember when I left, I said, hey, I'm not going to call you to check up on how are things, because I wouldn't want that from my predecessor. But if you ever want to talk to me, I'm always available.
Mm-hmm.
I try to stay out of it and let her do her thing. She's great. Shannon now.
I actually interviewed Shannon on a panel a few weeks back at the Independent Lodging Congress. We were doing
right? She's smart. I mean, I remember when I was looking for a CMO, I couldn't find someone that I believe was really have a great grasp of marketing in the hotel industry. I'm sure there are, but I didn't find it. So I went outside of the industry, and I've known her from Amex from the past. And I tried to recruit her once before for more of a sales role. I remember I think she jokingly said to me something like, if your CMO position ever opens up, I may be interested. By the way, once you fix the company, I'd be more interested.
Well, it seems to have worked out, so.
Yes, yes.
That's great. I'm curious, you know, you kind of mentioned some of the traits that you found important. What were some of the traits that you were looking for when you started bringing in your new executive team? Did you pull from within? Did you bring from the outside? And what were you looking for all those different roles?
Half and half. I promoted several from within, you know, into the next level position, the C-suite positions. And then I hired from outside as well. You know, we had a person in membership development, you know, Denise Omogunishin. She's great. She's still with them. I think she's with them for almost 20 years now, you know, and then I hired, you know, others from outside. So yeah, it's a combination of both. And I look at, you know, a company like Leading, you really have to, it's a complicated company that shouldn't be that complicated. So I look for people who can get to the essence of things, who's not trying to add more to the complications. I often say today's problem were yesterday's solutions. So if you when you think you're creating solutions, later on these solutions may become a problem in itself. So I was looking for people who can unravel rather than just slap another coat of paint on the marble. And so that was definitely one area that I was looking for. And also how people get along. I'm not one, there's a Gallup question that asks that, you know, do you have a best friend at work? I don't know. I think that's a tough call. I don't need people to be best friends, but I want them to be respectful of each other, and can build on each other. Best friends sometimes can become a bit subjective. I mean, there was that part of the culture that I encountered at Leading as well, was that some people found security in forming friendships.
Almost like alliances.
Exactly, it is. And, you know, if you watch those Survivor things, I mean, that's sort of what it is. Yeah. And I didn't want that. I want people to respect each other, but not necessarily, you know, social friends, so that to the point of you become very subjective. Because a lot of the business decisions needed to be made much more objectively. I knew Leading had to shift as a company. It was heavily on B2B. I know we had to shift from B2B to B2C. It was very heavily sales. We needed to shift more towards marketing, not to eliminate sales, but more towards marketing.
Why was that the case?
I felt that a lot of the things that we were doing was obsolete. It was no longer effective. It was from the past. And given today's environment, it needed to change. I'll give you an example. Why sales to marketing? Well, more and more of our members can reach the travel agents and all of that directly. So in the past, Leading, bless you, in the past, Leading was it. The hotel members didn't talk that much to the travel agents. That's no longer the case, given the trade shows, the events, and all of that. What Leading needed to do was reach directly to consumers, so that it for us to add value to our hotels, it was not just about the travel agents. Travel agents will always be important, and Leading has a different role to play. Matter of fact, I found that some of our salespeople were trying to keep our members from the sales, from the travel agents. It's like, wait, but then, you know, the hotel members tell travel agents to go to them directly, bypass Leading. Well, that tells you we're not adding a lot of value.
Right. So you essentially were fighting for that same business and losing relevancy.
One of the guiding principles I developed once I joined the company was preserve, enhance, invent. So preserve was to make sure we retain what's great about leading hotels and as member hotels. That also kept a lot of members more secure and comfortable. They were really worried that this chain brand guy is going to come in and destroy everything great. And hence is about what we're doing today, but we need to do them better. And then invent is about doing things that we're not currently doing. So it was about past, present, future, yesterday, today, tomorrow, in terms of a holistic approach as to what we need to do to be leading hotels of the world.
Absolutely. Well, I want to also talk a little bit about the role that you now play, which has a lot to do related to Cornell's Hotel Society. And I would love to ask you a few questions about what you're working on now, what your role is within the Hotel Society, and can you share a little bit more about that?
Sure. One of my classmates, Bill Minock, recruited me to join the CHS board. So I knew I was going to be president in 2021, and because of the rotational aspect of it. And I started looking at what do I want to do during my presidency? Believe it or not, one of the inspiration that came to me was watching the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I know, you're going to laugh at me. John Bon Jovi was inducted that year, and you can look it up when he was inducted. And I remember him saying something to the effect that I've been looking forward to this moment all my life, right? And it occurred to me that the Cornell Hotel School does not have a recognition program for hoteliers. Yes, we have an Icon Innovator. Icon generally is not a hotelier, even though this year was Keith Barr. And the innovator tends to be a little bit more likely to be a hotelier. And so the idea of a Hall of Fame, I started developing it, put more and more slides together, started talking to the people at the school and development, and eventually came up with the concept that I presented to Dean Walsh and at the time the College of Business, Kevin Hollock. So a lot of work led up to it. And in 2021, we were looking at launching it, but it was still too early in terms of COVID recovery. So we ended up launching it in 2022. That was the inaugural year. Denise Omergunnison chairs the nomination selection committee. And right now we have 13 people. And it's hard work. It really is. And for me, the work is year round. We literally started last December, thinking about the class of 2024. We finalized the class of 2024, and we submitted to CHS board for approval. And then this morning, I just heard from Dean Walsh. She's good to go on that also. So the class of 2024 has been selected, 11 inductees and one rising star. And we're preparing to contact the inductees to make sure they're okay to be honored. And then we'll be announcing it probably mid-July or so. So that's a year-round work for me. And we also, obviously we do the event. We'll also do the and assign an auction, online auction with it. So it's fun. I wish I'd known some of these inductees when I was a student. Mm-hmm. But this is the great work of everybody talks about the Cornell Hotel School brand so famous. Why is it so famous? It's because of hoteliers out there doing great things and really build the industry. And we want to tell the stories of these people. These are pioneers. They did it with a lot less. They did it when, they didn't have the infrastructure to support them. And today, they're not doing the same things anymore, but they are doing great things. So it's been very rewarding. This is the third year. I've committed to do this for 5 years. So my biggest task now is finding somebody who's going to carry this on.
Amazing. It's great to hear. Well, when people start talking about it, I'm going to let them know that you got inspired from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Absolutely. John Bon Jovi.
That's amazing. Well, I want to cap off kind of this chat with you by asking you more of a general question. It's all right. I want to ask, looking forward, you have a big front row seat to a lot of this industry, as well as people that are in the industry, people that are in university still at Cornell and many other schools. What are you most excited about that the industry holds for the future? What is getting you excited about what you're seeing with that front row seat for the coming years?
Not always in a good sense. Right? So if you look at my career, two things change the most. Who are the owners of hotels? And how does a guest make a reservation, hotel reservation? Ownership, distribution. These are the two things that change the most and has profound impact on the entire industry. And there are some things that really worry me. I think we are an industry built on cheap labor or expectation of cheap labor. That's not very sustainable because every human being wants to better themselves and their families. So I think that model won't work, and all this crying about staff shortage and all, which you're helping to solve, is not, to me, well, first of all, it's a self-inflicted wound, right? We're the one who laid off all the employees. And we used to say people are most important assets. And then we said we didn't mean it. Capital is our most important asset. So that's a reckoning the industry has to come to. My belief is this industry has to get to a point where it's providing meaningful and well-paying compensation. Some of the tasks will be automated. That's fine. But hopefully we put more resource into the human interaction to make a difference. Right now, what worries me is the masters of hotel investment is very willing to put money into the facilities, into the properties, and not really investing in people. And that worries me, because that usually go towards more of a commodity product rather than a premium product. That's one area. Another area that, you know, probably not a surprise is the whole, you know, generative AI. It excites me and it worries me. It excites me in terms of the possibilities of having another tool like AI. It would be just amazing of what we can deliver to the guests. But AI by itself will be disappointing. It's just not rich enough. You know, it's like using a tool or half using a tool. And I think that's the part that I worry about. It's like, you know, early automation, we had a lot of problems with people not happy with automation. And I think we're going to repeat the same mistake on AI. And so that part worries me and excites me at the same time. And I say, lastly, I'm excited. All these are two-sided coins and swords. Is third-party innovations. This is an industry I've been disappointed with lack of innovation ourselves. And it comes from lack of investments, and third parties will see the opportunity and come in and will take a good economic share of it. OTA is a prime example. Ask anybody who made money on in-room minibars. that was not a hotel innovation. That was the outside vendors who wanted to sell refrigerators because they're the one who made the money. It's not the hotel that sold, you know, $6 Cokes. Anyway, so the relationship between the industry and third parties, I think, can be a lot more synergistic, that we can work together and produce greater innovations. Right now, I think hotel companies tend to sit back and be takers of innovation rather than sort of, you know, drivers of innovation. So I think that part, it's an opportunity, but it also scares me that we continue to be turned into commodities. Yeah, where to invest? AI, and relationship with third parties.
Well, thank you, Ted. That's fantastic. And I appreciate you taking the time. I really, really always enjoy talking to you, and I appreciate you doing this with us.
My pleasure.